The prophets in the future. It's very simple, so we'll just say a couple words and move on. Would I invite you to think relationally about this? What does it mean to be in a relationship and to plan a future? God, I would say, so enters into relationships that the future is not all mapped out. What you do and say counts with respect to the shape of the future. God honors, values what you do and say, and that will have an effect on the future. God catches us up in planning a future. There's a phrase out and about. Somebody has a close call, and it wasn't my time. As if there were a specific time out there at which we will all die. I'll take as many risks as I want. Time's all set. I'll smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Time's all set. I'll drive recklessly. For me and for others, into whom I might encounter on some road, time's all set. It doesn't make any difference. What I do about anything. Time is all set. I would submit that's not faith, that's fate, fatalism. If we go back into early times in the Old Testament, the first glimpses of the people of God in the story of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, one of the characteristics of this beginning, Genesis 12 on, I mean, that story begins with a promise. That's how things began with this people. Read Genesis 12, 1 to 3 again. Go, and there's a string of promises that God gives to Abraham at the beginning of things. Many, a land, blessing, many descendants, nation, a great name. Promises, promises, promises. There they are at the beginning. And they shape in a decisive way who he is, what he's about, life of this family as it moves through the years. So at the very beginning of Israel's life, there are sort of embedded within the very call of Abraham himself, there's this element of hope, of expectation, of moving toward a goal, surrounded by God's promises. Now, so when we come to the prophets, there's already a history, a story of movement from promise to fulfillment. It's something new. It's not something new with the prophets. So when the prophets come on the scene, there are new articulations of the promise, but that future about which the prophets speak is grounded in a God whom they know to have been faithful to promises made before they arrived on the scene. They, these prophets, had, as their predecessors in the Israelite community had experienced this God as a promise keeper. Now this, of course, shapes who they are and what they bring. What happens in the prophets, I think, basically, as you move through those years of the prophetic materials, is that the future is more sharply drawn, and they pick up this pattern of promise and fulfillment that's already present in their life of their community. and they intensify the character of the goal toward which the people of God are moving. And so the goal toward which they're moving becomes much more sharply differentiated from the present situation than was earlier the case. And as you move through the prophets and move into later apocalyptic, then the movement toward the fulfillment of the promise envisions a more radical break from the present. And so you get finally to the point of beyond history, at least as we know it. I'm amazed at how common the language of fatalism creeps into our thinking about the future. Take justice issues, environmental issues. What's the phrase that's out there? The future is in God's hands. Doesn't make any difference what we do regarding these matters. Future's in God's hands. I would submit that to leave the future simply in God's hands is to denigrate human responsibility and, I think, to tempt God. To do such a thing would be very similar to the devil's temptation of Jesus. Jump off the top of the temple, Jesus. God will send his angels to pick you up from the rocks below and save you from death and destruction. And Jesus replied, and that's, by the way, basically the devil quotes Psalm 91 there. Interesting. Jesus replied, that would tempt God. Certainly we can leave the future ultimately in God's hands, yes. But God's relationship with us that God has chosen to have is such that we're given a great deal to say and do about the shape of not only the future of ourselves, but the future of the communities of which we're a part. And we might say, the shape of the future of the less fortunate among us. One of the reasons I think commonly for the nonchalance, the common nonchalance with regard to the care of the less fortunate among us is their future's all set. Nothing we do is going to make any difference with regard to the shape of their future. Future is partly settled, I would say. It's partly unsettled. Partly settled. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. Count on it, okay? God will raise you from the dead. Count on it. That's settled. But the future is also unsettled. Your words and deeds with respect to, say, the less fortunate in our midst will make a difference with regard to the shape of their future and yours. I didn't keep an exact tally of the conversations that I've had over these days, but I would guess that the question or the topic that was raised more often with me one-on-one or in small groups had to do with the will of God. I don't know whether that says something about this particular context. I'm concerned. Well, I maybe something I said. So one of the things decided to do was to pick up on a sermon and a few paragraphs from a sermon that I would highly commend to you with regard to thinking about the will of God, by William Sloan Coffin, Jr. It's the sermon he preached upon the accidental death of his son, Alexander. This is back in the 80s. You can Google it. It's available. Just a couple of paragraphs from this sermon, which speaks of the will of God in remarkable ways. On an early January night, while driving in a terrible storm, my son Alexander, who to his friends was a real day brightener, and to his family fair as a star when only one is shining in the sky, My 24-year-old Alexander, who enjoyed beating his old man in every game and in every race, beat his father to the grave. Many things can be said when a person dies, but there's at least one thing that should never be said. The night after Alex died, I was sitting in the living room of my sister's house outside of Boston when the front door opened and in came a nice-looking middle-aged woman carrying about 18 quiches. And when she saw me, she shook her head, headed for the kitchen, saying sadly over her shoulder, "I just don't understand the will of God." Instantly, I was up and in hot pursuit, swarming all over her. "I'll say you don't, lady," I said. I knew the anger would do me good, and the instruction to her was long overdue. And remember now, this is the father preaching the sermon at the funeral of his son. I continued, "Do you think it was the will of God that Alex never fixed that lousy windshield wiper of his? That he was probably driving too fast in such a storm, that he probably had had a couple of frosties too many? Do you think it's God's will that there are no street lights along that stretch of road and no guardrails separating the road and Boston Harbor? Nothing's..." Hard. It's the father speaking again. "Nothing so infuriates me as the incapacity of seemingly intelligent people to get it through their heads that God doesn't go around this world with his finger on triggers, his fist around knives, and his hands on steering wheels. God is against all unnatural deaths, and Christ spent an inordinate amount of time delivering people from paralysis, insanity, leprosy, and mutinous. There are, of course, nature-caused deaths that are untimely and slow and pain-ridden and hard to understand. But violent deaths, such as the one Alex died, to understand those is a piece of cake. As his younger brother put it simply, standing at the head of the casket at the Boston funeral, "You blew it, buddy. You blew it." The one thing that should never be said when someone dies is, "It's the will of God." Never do we know enough to say that. I'll conclude with this. My consolation lies in knowing that it was not the will of God that my son Alex die. And this connects with some of the things we were saying yesterday, that when the waves closed over his sinking car, God's was the first of all of our hearts to break. One of the classic definitions of prophet is a predictor of the future. And I want to say to that, yes and no. To use the language of prediction is to make the prophet's language much more specific than it actually usually is. The prophets were rarely concerned about precision regarding future times and places. This is evident in the fact of that calendar concerns, for example, are rare in the prophets. And the two most basic examples of calendar concerns are, let's see, Jonah, 40 days and you've had it. Well, he turned out to be wrong. And the other one was Jeremiah 25 in terms of the length of the exile. And boy, you've got to fuss a lot in order to find the exact length of the exile out of what he says. The prophets do have a basic future orientation. I think there's little doubt about that. But it would be much truer of their message to speak of the prophet as one who proclaims the future, who announces the future, rather than one who predicts the future. We could go through various pieces of evidence in these texts. I don't want to go into too much detail here. But if you just move through the prophets, you could see the illustrations of the point that I just made. I'll tick off maybe four of them here in terms of the type of detail that would need to be developed much further. But note how common the non-specific language with regard to the future is in the prophets. In that day, in the latter days. Oh, the foe from the north, remember? Okay. What, all that non-specificity there. Or second, the use of metaphors in the shaping of the future really has some interesting, just think about metaphors that are used. Say Isaiah 40, verses 3 following, a voice cries out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill be made low. Uneven ground shall become level, the rough places a plain. See, if you don't understand that as metaphor, then heaven is going to look like Kansas, right? Okay? Be prepared for metaphor. And what that does is it stretches you with regard to the shape here of the future that the prophets are talking about. Or three, hyperbolic speech. In the prophets, all kinds of references could be made here, but let me go to Jeremiah 4. It's a wonderful text from a variety of perspectives, not least in this environmentally sensitive age. I looked on the earth, and lo, it was waste and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and lo, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. I looked, and lo, there was no one at all, and all the birds of the air had fled. I looked, and lo, the fruitful land was a desert, and all its cities were laid in ruin before the Lord, before his fierce anger. So, is that hyperbolic? Given the shape of the future that occurs in what's subsequent to Jeremiah himself. Or another matter that should soften our understanding of the prophets as predictor is the adjustments that prophets make in view of changing circumstances. And so, for example, listen to Isaiah 31. This is an association with the Syrian onslaught in the 8th century. And so just verses 4 and 5 of 31, we could read more. Thus said the Lord to me, as a lion or a young lion growls over its prey, and when a band of shepherds is called out against it, is not terrified by their shouting or daunted at their noise, so the Lord of hosts will come down and will fight upon Mount Zion and upon its hill like birds hovering overhead. So the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect it and deliver it. He will spare it and rescue it. And there were some prophets at the time of Jeremiah, and when Babylon was the threat, who took that promise and applied it again at that later time, and they turned out to be wrong. So you can't take these words of the prophets and just plug them in along the historical line. Context change. There are adjustments that prophets will make in view of changing circumstances with regard to the nature of the promise that's appropriate for this particular time and place. Best example I know about it, I got this somewhere, I don't know, 30 years ago, and I've forgotten where it came from, so apologies to the original author of this, but tells the story about a father at the end of the 19th century. Father made a promise to his son that if the son would maintain certain patterns of behavior until he was 21 years old, the father would give him, on his 21st birthday, would give him a horse and buggy. And years went by, and the son made good on his end of the bargain. Time for fulfillment of the promise on the part of the father was at hand. And in the meantime, Henry Ford had been at work. And the young men, 21 years old, were riding Model Ts. The last thing on earth that this son wanted was a horse and buggy. But the father had made a promise. And hence, really, the only way in which the father could fulfill the promise was to give his son not a horse and buggy, but a car. Had the father insisted on fulfilling the promise, precise terms in which the promise had been given, it would have been no real fulfillment. Would not have achieved the purpose that the father had in mind when he made the promise. True fulfillment there would be, meant a change in the form of the fulfillment. And so it is with God's promises. The prophets spoke promises of God in a form adapted to the days in which they lived. When the promises were fulfilled in Jesus Christ, the form of their fulfillment was altered compared to what the prophets said. And tragically, many of the Jews, Jesus' contemporaries, were so tied to the form of the promise that they lost the meaning. And they could not see that Jesus was, in fact, the true fulfillment of God's promises in another and better form than that in which they had been made. The disciples, however, penetrated the form to the inner meaning of the promise. And so fulfillment of the prophetic promise, yes, Jesus was that, but at a deeper and more meaningful level than a literal fulfillment would ever produce, than the prophets ever imagined. We need to remember that it takes faith to discern that a prophecy has been fulfilled, not a kind of quasi-scientific analysis of the correspondence that may exist between the details of the promise and the details of the fulfillment. The correspondences that may exist between prophetic words and later events must never be used as an occasion to walk by sight rather than by faith. Let me say this straight out. Prophecy is never a witness to itself. Look how great I can talk about the future. Prophecy is a witness to the faithfulness of God. Witness to the faithfulness of God, not a witness to its ability to predict. And that faithfulness of God can only be discerned by a person of faith. So that, given the fact that there is seldom a literal correspondence between Old Testament prophecy and New Testament fulfillment, that pattern will doubtlessly persist, so that there will continue to be seldom a literal correspondence between a prophetic word and some future time. I worry about these people who are looking for such a specific future. They're looking for a horse and buggy, and they're going to get a car. Will they recognize it? The prophets do have a basic future orientation. Yes, indeed. But it would be much truer to their message, I think, to speak of the prophet as one then who announces a word, proclaims a word about the future. The second matter to remember here is that there's often a contingent element with respect to prophetic words of indictment and judgment. And these contingent elements are striking in terms of what they lift up for our attention. Let me use a text in Jeremiah 22. Jeremiah 22, beginning with verse 1. Thus says the Lord, go down to the house of, to Jeremiah, to the house of the king of Judah, and speak there this word. And say, hear the word of the Lord, O king of Judah, sitting on the throne of David, you and your servants and your people who enter these gates. Thus says the Lord, act with justice and righteousness and deliver from the hand of the oppressor anyone who has been robbed, and do no wrong or violence to the alien, the orphan, and the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place. Now watch, for if you will indeed obey this word, God says, then through the gates of this house shall enter kings who sit on the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, they and their servants and their people. But if you will not heed these words, I swear by myself, says the Lord, that this house shall become a desolation. Notice what is happening here with respect to, use my hands. Act with justice. Or contemporary, take care of the environment. If you do, this is going to be your future. If you do not, then this is going to be your future. Two possible futures are held out here for the people, depending upon what they do. And the striking is that what they do will affect not only their own futures, it'll affect the future of God. If they do this, then God will do this. If they don't do this, then God is going to do something else. So God's own future is shaped in some way by what people do. Those kinds of if contingent clauses that we have in the material are very striking to us. And we need, I think, somehow to take them more seriously than we do. For each of these options that are laid out by the prophet to have integrity, God cannot absolutely know what in fact will happen. That's not to say that God is not omniscient. At least at the time that the oracle is delivered. If God knows for certain that the negative future that's laid out will occur, then for God to offer the positive future would be a deception. Divine deception, of course, is a possibility. I mean, we need to reckon with that possibility. It seems unlikely, however, for all either or offers of the prophets and others would be open to such, well, let's see, we got deception on our hands here or not. It seems more true to the text that God offers genuine options to king and to people here. And then if, verse 4, if there is a genuine possibility for the king, then it must be finally a possibility for God as well. Not an absolutely finally shaped future. For God to speak in terms of a possibility or a probability suggests some uncertainty with regard to what will in fact occur. Such language, it seems to me, shows how deeply God has entered into Israel's situation. God is faced with possibilities such as Israel is. God is faced with these various possibilities, with all that this dilemma means in terms of reflection and planning and openness to alternative courses of action and so forth, depending upon the course of events. Where the divine perspective, where God's perspective exceeds the human, lies in the ability to delineate all the possibilities of the future, the likelihood of their occurrence, and particularly the thoroughgoing divine knowledge of the past and the present. Yet, it seems to me that texts like this, I know it's hard, it seems to me that texts like this want to say that God, too, moves into a future which is to some extent unknown. Maybe when we reflect on the power of God, we say, you know, can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? We say that's illogical. Would it also be illogical to claim that God can know a specific future that is not yet available for knowledge? Would that be illogical? The future, it seems to me, is settled and unsettled, but what people do counts with respect to the shape of a future. Now, another text. Let's lift up this contingent element with regard to the shape of the future and lift up Micah chapter 3, verse 12. Micah chapter 3, verse 12 is the longest prophetic text that quotes, Micah chapter 3, verse 12 is the longest quoted text that we have in the prophets. It's quoted in Jeremiah 26. And notice what Micah chapter 3, verse 12 says. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. No ifs, ands, or buts there. That's the shape of the future Micah announces in the 8th century. Jeremiah comes along a couple hundred years later, and look what Jeremiah says in chapter 26. And there's a specific citation this time, beginning with verse 18. Micah of Moresheth, who prophesied during days of King Hezekiah of Judah and said to all the people of Judah, thus says the Lord of hosts, Zion shall be plowed as a field, Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. There it is. That's the longest quotation of one prophet by another. And then notice verse 19. Did King Hezekiah and Judah and all Judah put him to death? Did he not fear the Lord and entreat the favor of the Lord? And didn't the Lord change his mind about the disaster that he had pronounced against them? So there you have an announcement by the prophet Micah that's specifically cited as something about which God changed God's mind. There's a contingency element here with respect to the shape of the future. What people do counts. People do counts. God takes human response into consideration when it comes to the question of fulfillment. Not all prophetic texts are have contingencies in them, you understand. But so the future is not mechanically set out just because some prophet says so. The situation of those who hear and what they do with what they hear can shape the word, shape the future in significant ways. Let's see, what are we doing on time here? Let me skip past a couple of things here. The future, as I suggested, is not only open for us, it's open for God. And just think for a moment about this. What would it mean for God if everything were settled? One of my students a few years ago said one word in response to that question. Boring. God himself would not be free to act except in predetermined ways. To put it crassly, God would have to consult his own foreknowledge to know what to do next. You know, a book published several decades ago entitled The Encyclopedia of Biblical Prophecy, edited by J. Barton Payne, had God announcing some 8,000 plus scriptural prophecies stretching out over the centuries, with an indication of how many had been fulfilled and how many were left to be fulfilled. Can you imagine God saying to himself,
only 347 more to go?
Can you imagine that? Or think of what it would mean for us if the future were entirely settled. What if there were no open possibilities? Wouldn't that undercut a meaningful life? If we can't contribute anything to our future, we would not be motivated to make our best choices. We would not be motivated to take responsibility in some fundamental way for our own futures. Life is truly life only if there are possibilities and not just certainties. Why pour out your own life if the future is whatever will be, will be? My grandpa, who was a pastor, died of colon cancer before he should have died. And on the way, when they discovered some of the symptoms here, well, go to the doctor, Grandpa. No, I'm not going to the doctor. My future is in God's hands. I'm placing my future in the hands of God. I think, again, how do we understand such things? How do we contribute to the actions and words of people that use out there if they understand that their futures are absolutely settled? You know, we commonly have an understanding of God that is atemporal, that God is above and beyond time. I would like to ask you to think for just a moment about Genesis 2, verses 1 to 3, where it says, God rested on the seventh day. In order to take that kind of text seriously, it seems to me, we need to say, time, God understands that time is real for God. My father taught me in confirmation that God stands on this high mountain and can overlook all of history from beginning to end. And this has the potential, I think, for making certain texts incoherent, consciously or not. For example, it says many texts speak of God being provoked to anger. But if God knows the future in absolute detail, then God should have been angry from all eternity and not provoked to anger at any particular time and place. One might say something comparable about those texts where God makes plans for the future and then proceeds to execute those plans. I mean, why the distinction between making plans and executing plans if you know absolutely what the future will bring? Texts such as these suggest that there is a temporal succession, a before and after in divine thinking. And these make the most sense, it seems to me, when one assumes that in creation, God chose to relate to the world from within its structures of time, so that God, like the world, has a past, a present, and a future. God is eternal, but not timeless. God is freely now, it's God's own move, freely chosen to enter into the time of the world and truly shares in this history which we experience. In some sense, don't we have to speak of the story of God, the history of God, where God gets genuinely, I mean, all those tears of God that we saw, where God gets genuinely caught up in the journey of God's people and the journey of God's world. The birth and death of Jesus are genuinely temporal events for God. in the fullness of time, God sent forth a son. People do shape the future and have the capacity to affect the shape of that future. Let me finally say a couple things. Not too much here. Texts such as we have dealt with here place a key responsibility for the shape of the future of church, future of the world, on our plates as human beings. We, as people of faith, are called not to simply rest back and let God take care of everything, as if the future of the creation were solely in God's hands. Ultimately, yes. But in the meantime, human beings are called not to passivity, but to genuine engagement with respect to the shape of the future. And the decisions that we make, the words we speak, the actions that we carry out will have significant implications for the shape of the future of the church and the world. And given those texts, can we go here? They will even have an effect on the future of God. God will do one thing or another thing depending upon what we do. What you do and say counts. One of the images I like to use for the new heaven and the new earth, which God is bringing into being, is a quilt. And the Psalm 139 uses the image of God as a seamstress who puts patches of quilt together. And so the quilt that God is bringing into being consists of a bunch of patches. And you, by what you do and say, are going to contribute a patch to that quilt. And that quilt, the shape of the quilt, the color of the quilt, the size of the quilt that God is weaving will be affected in important ways by what you do and what you say. Count on it. And I wish you best, the best, as you work on that future to which you have been called. Thank you very much.